Chapter 12. Purpose, Evaluation, Motivation, Intention. In the heading of this stage, four elements have been grouped because they are interrelated in such a way that they should not be treated as different stages. In fact, a purpose is the will to reach a goal, an objective, but a goal is not such if it is not regarded as valuable. Similarly, a motive is not a motive if it does not move, if it does not impel toward a goal. And the direction of the motive is given by intention. Moreover, these aspects do not always succeed each other in a fixed order. Sometimes motive or an intention appears first to the consciousness. For example, a prompting towards some ideal not yet clear or defined. Or one becomes aware of a moral, social, ascetic, or religious value, which only later becomes connected to an aim, a specific goal to be achieved. At other times, the vision comes first, the intuitive flash, the illumination that reveals a goal or task, to which a value is then attributed, and this arouses the motives which urge towards actualization and the intention to achieve it. Thus, there can be a variety of dynamic relationships among purpose, evaluation, motive, and intention. Another way of indicating these relationships is as follows. Motives and intentions are based on evaluations. Evaluations are based on the meaning attributed to life. But this meaning, in its turn, is given by the aim or purpose of life itself and by its achievement. Therefore, it is very helpful for putting the will into operation to have a positive conception of the meaning and purpose of life, to admit, first of all, that life has a purpose which is meaningful, second, that this purpose is positive, constructive, valuable, in one word, that it is good. Of this, we can become aware through observation or introspection, but when we come to a closer study of motivation, things become more complicated. Psychoanalysis has laid great emphasis upon the fact that unconscious motivations exist, and that often we act in the belief that we do so from a given conscious motive, when reality we are also, or principally, impelled by drivers of which we are not aware. These overcome the censorship of the ego by means of rationalization. But even before psychoanalysis, attention had been called to the human tendency to find apparently good justifications for actions that are not good. Justifications to ourselves and justifications to others. This tendency could be compared to the pleading of an inner attorney who defends the cause of the more intense urges operating in the unconscious. In this connection, we can see one of these reactions or extreme oscillations that appear frequently in life. Classical psychology took account of only the conscious motivations. Then, by contrast, psychoanalysis concerned itself only, or almost only, with the unconscious motivations and urges, thus arriving, for all practical purposes, at the negation of the will. It may be said that, as in many other cases, the truth lies in the middle. There are conscious motivations and unconscious motivations, or rather, one might say more accurately that there is almost always a combination of the two, in very variable proportions. Thus, an accurate analysis is required for using the will function with true awareness. Either a self-analysis or an analysis by a therapist or an educator, according to the case. This occasion does not permit my dwelling on the techniques of this analysis. I will simply point out an error into which we very often fall when we become aware of the motives within us. In Chapter 6, The Practical Applications of the Skillful Will, I have recommended the technique of acting as if, that is, of acting as if a psychological attitude existed in us, instead of the contrary one. Some are shocked at the use of this method because they consider it hypocritical. They say, in effect, if I am angry and harbour resentment against someone for whatever reason, good or bad, and if I treat him with kindness and smiles, I am not being authentic, true to myself. But in reality, it is not a question of hypocrisy. It is due to the psychological multiplicity that exists in each of us. Acting as if would be hypocritical if we did so with the purpose of deceiving others for selfish ends, or if we deceived ourselves into believing that our lower motives do not exist. But if, when an impulse or motive of hostility and resentment against someone arises in us, we, our true genuine self, do not approve of it and refuse to identify with it, then our real will is to choose the better motive and to act benevolently in spite of the impulse that urges us to treat the person badly. We can choose the motive to which we give free course. Generally, opposite motives or urges in us tend to neutralize one another, and our task consists in its intensifying the potential of the energies of goodwill and understanding so that they not only neutralize the hostile drives, but are stronger than they. Here, however, a reservation should be made, lest we fall into the Victorian trap of being repressive, and thus suffer from reactions of suppressed or repressed energies. Should, for example, the hostile tendencies be very intense, acting as if is not sufficient, and, if used prematurely, can provoke undesirable results. In these cases, the methods of harmless discharge, catharsis, and of transmutation and sublimation should first be employed. In saying this, I am not recommended that one never be aggressive or that one never fight. I mean that one has the freedom of choice about whether and to what extent to give direct expression to the impulse or motive, even if it be one of deeply felt anger or hurt. Furthermore, in making this choice, this decision, we can make use of the resources of clear understanding, as well as of the guidance of the transpersonal self. The point is that choices and decisions are possible. The act of will and intention then involves a decision to accept or not accept an impulse. Authenticity does not consist in giving in to a bad motive simply because it exists. Considered in this light, to behave in a benevolent manner, even though one feels an impulse of anger, can be the highest form of sincerity, for it corresponds to what we would wish to be completely, and already are partially. Such a recognition eliminates the misunderstanding about authenticity. Many, in fact, behave badly and excuse themselves on the score of being authentic, but this is often the authenticity of the caveman. The method of acting as if we possess the desired feelings is neither a sham nor hypocrisy. It is an effective way of becoming more and more what we wish we could be continuously. We are essentially and genuinely what we will to be, even if we often fail to manifest it. In considering motivations, then, one is helped by distinguishing between two classes which we may designate respectively as drives, urges, and reasons. Drives and urges can be conscious or unconscious and can be generally regarded as spontaneous tendencies which move us or tend us to do so. Reasons, on the other hand, to be really such, must be conscious and have a cognitive mental aspect. They presuppose a clear vision of the goal, a recognition of its value, and the intention to reach it. One can take a drive or urge, test its rationality, and transform it into a reason. If we look more closely at the evaluation of motivations, we see that frequently they cannot be labelled simply as good or bad. Honest observations, first of all of ourselves and then of others, frequently reveals that the motives and reasons that determine actions are multiple and of various kinds. A mixture of selfish and altruistic motives is frequent. Those whose approach is exclusively psychoanalytical maintain that real motives are the instinctual and lower ones, and that the others are simply a cloak, a rationalization of them. At the other extreme, the rigid and uncompromising idealists demand for themselves and for others an absolute purity of intention and condemn every motive that does not meet this criterion. But the existence of lower motives, let us designate them thus merely for simplicity of language, does not exclude the coexistence and genuineness of higher motives. The fundamental multiplicity of the human being and of his being aware and therefore acting on and from different levels guarantees the multiplicity of motives, all of which are equally real, genuine, and authentic. The nature of psychological conflicts can be explained in these terms. Many of them could be said to be conflicts between various levels of intentions and motives. But there is another interesting fact. The reasons and motives of different levels are not always in conflict. Often not only do they coexist peacefully, but they also converge towards the same goal and participate in, and thus cooperate in, the executing the same volitional act. An interpretation of the paradoxical Talmudic saying, "Serve God both with your bad impulses and with your good impulses," becomes possible. In modern psychological language, we might say that such service is equivalent to directing all the biopsychological tendencies to higher purposes and creative activities. To do so presents a number of advantages. The first is the avoidance of the condemnation and repression into the unconscious of the lower drives, or the forestalling of a depressing guilt feeling and the harmful consequences arising from it. The knowledge of the existence of these lower elements in ourselves need neither surprise nor depress us. They exist in all human beings. Everyone is a little world, a microcosm in which all the kingdoms of nature are represented, the mineral and the bones, etc., the vegetative life, the animal instincts, the human conditions, from primitive man to the highest human possibilities. At the present time, we represent the sum of all the evolution of the past from the mineral kingdom on. But evolution does not stop with the so-called Homo sapiens. Evolution is continuous, and our task is to carry forward and foster this great evolutionary impulse, without, however, repudiating the previous stages. Accepting the multiplicity of our motivations not only helps us to avoid repression, but also leads to the utilization, in individually and socially productive ways, of potent energies that otherwise may erupt in harmful and destructive directions. It is analogous to the channeling of torrential waters to serve a power station. And when the tendency is excessive, it can be regulated by mobilizing another, opposite tendency against it, as occasion demands and the goal indicates. Pitting ambition and the desire for possessions, for example, against laziness, or inversely, balancing a tendency to excessive activism by cultivating a desire for the quiet life. This is one of the more subtle and effective arts of volitional action. Not to oppose directly or launch frontal attacks, but to manoeuvre skillfully. And it is accomplished primarily through the feeding power of attention, as was discussed in the chapters on the skillful will. The third advantage of directing all psychological tendencies towards creative purposes accrues from the manner in which these tendencies, the very energies themselves, become transmuted and sublimated through being redirected to higher ends. This process of transmutation of the psychological energies has great importance and broad application. It deserves to be much better known and more widely practiced, since it constitutes the most effective and constructive method of dealing with two major and potent sources of energy, sex and aggressiveness. This has been discussed in some detail in Chapter 6, pages 62 through 65. Concerning the combining or converging of motives in determining decisions and activities that result from them, we can often observe that, side by side with humanitarian reasons, other motives are present, such as ambition, vanity, the desire for recognition, the approval of others, self-assertion, etc. Therefore, it is not appropriate to pass judgments of good and bad, higher or lower, in any absolute sense. All is relative to the individual, to his evolutionary stage, to his environmental circumstances, and to many other factors. To state it in an oversimplified way, what may be good in one is bad in another. The great Renaissance philosopher Tommaso Campanella observed, "In God we shall see who did and said the better thing." Thus, it is the course of wisdom to follow Christ's injunction, "Judge not." The objection might be made that every volitional act involves evaluation, an assessment, that is, a value judgment. While this is true, we should not confuse two different meanings of the word judgment and two different ways of using it. In speaking of judgment, one usually means moral judgment, condemnation, approval, or often, more often, censure, condemnation, which incidentally give their use a sense of superiority. Instead, the judgments necessary in the first stage of the volitional act, and also in the second deliberative one, are, as we shall see, objective rational evaluations, arrived at on the basis of many and diverse elements. The more precise word in this case is clear discrimination. In our examination of motives, then, we should recognise that the lower ones constitute a subjective ethical imperfection, but not an objective obstacle. They can indeed promote the accomplishment of the more lofty activities. In the field of the arts, for example, aside from higher inspiration and spontaneous creative impulse, creativity can be stimulated and intensified by the spur of practical necessity. Two outstanding examples of this have been Balzac and Dostoevsky. They were goaded by economic need, Dostoevsky because of his passion for gambling, Balzac on account of debts contracted by his luxurious style of living and his improvident habit of rewriting his novels many times when they reached the proof stage. As it turned out, the spur caused them to both produce a greater number of works than they otherwise would have done. Yet the urge of financial stringency does not seem to have influenced the quality of the literary product. This is evident in the case of Balzac, from the fact that one of his heaviest expenses was directly attributable to his artistic scruples, which induced him to rewrite the same work several times. The composer Rossini provides a contrasting example, which constitutes a confirmation of a negative kind. When he became rich and famous, courted and adored by all Paris, he lacked sufficient incentive to overcome his natural laziness and epicureanism, and ceased to write operas of quality. Had he been more ambitious or intent on earning more and more money, probably we would have had some more masterpieces. Therefore, the less elevated motives can not only be profitably utilised, but also at times deliberately aroused. For example, making public pledges in order to avoid the shame of not keeping them, or promising ourselves rewards of various kinds, the carrot method. Recourse to these means could be considered an act of humility, since it implies recognition of the existence in us of these lower or simply personal elements. What is important is to make sure that the lower motives are aligned with the higher motives, and that it is these that are in control and determine the action. I have specified clear-cut supremacy, but perhaps one might even be content with just a modicum of supremacy. When a group possesses 51% of the shares of a company, it determines its policy. Analogously, in volitional action, even a slight supremacy of higher motives suffices to ensure that the lower ones, even if strong, have not the say in decisions and actions, and that they remain harmless or even useful, as are the minority shareholders who bring capital. On the other hand, it is well to be aware that all this can be accomplished by drawbacks and dangers. The will must be kept vigilant that the lower motives may not become strengthened and prevail, leading to illusion, compromise, and deviation from the initial aim or predetermined purpose. Moreover, all this concerns the achievement of external aims, when instead, inner developmental transpersonal realization is the goal. The comparatively lower drives and energies have to be transformed and sublimated through the action of higher motives and the attractive pull of the higher goals. Let me summarise this chapter by applying these observations to the person intent on carrying through the first stage of the act of will, so that he may begin in his willed act with the maximum possibility of success. That person must get his goals or purposes clearly in view. Then he must evaluate his goals. In the process of evaluation, he will examine his motives, trying to become aware of the unconscious ones. It is a testing of the worthwhileness of what has been seen as a goal. My main point on this chapter has concerned the nature of motives, however. After being examined, motives must be aroused and used. Otherwise, the setting of goals and the analysis of self remain only academic. Psychological energies must be set into motion and used with clear intent in the service of the higher good, must be mastered and combined so that will can effectively proceed to action that will lead from goals to accomplishment. With this initial zest, a person can proceed to the deliberate examination of the ways in which he can actually achieve a given aim. Without the dynamism of his motives, no matter how clear his aims or worthwhile they may be, a person can lack the drive to go on and will remain only a dreamer instead of the doer of the willed action. End of chapter 12.